All right, it's time for us to begin our study tonight. If you would please open your Bibles to 1 Kings chapter 12. 1 Kings chapter 12. Good to see all of you tonight. We're beginning a study of the period of time in Old Testament history identified as the divided kingdom. I'd like you to remember this kind of breakdown of Old Testament history because it does break it into pieces where we can remember the events that take place in these periods of time. This particular lesson is going to be somewhat of an introduction, as you see, an overview of the divided kingdom. Now, as our lessons proceed, we're going to dig a little deeper into the text itself and discuss some specific kings and things that they did and things that they didn't do. But I hope that
I can generate a little bit of an exciting attitude about this particular period of Old Testament history. I know that when I introduced the study of the history and geography of the Bible, I tried to generate a bit of enthusiasm because a lot of people don't really study like you're studying in this segment especially. And a lot of people look at Old Testament history especially as something that's just boring. And remembering events and facts and that sort of thing is something that's boring. And I think the more that I study, the more exciting this period of the kings really becomes. And so I want you to put some time into reading. And I think you'll find that when you start to read this section of 1 Kings 12 through 2 Kings chapter 25, I think that's supposed to be chapter 25. Chapter 25. And then 2 Chronicles 10 through 36, you may find it difficult to stop and say, well, that's enough for now, I'll pick that up later. Because I think it's a very exciting period of time. You've got folks that are kings, but only for a very short time, until somebody else that decides they want to be king kills that man and he establishes a new dynasty. It is. It's better than a soap opera. There's more drama. And so if you read this, read it carefully, I think you'll find it to be very readable and very exciting. Try not to get bogged down with the names. If you find a name that's confusing to you, make a note of that and let's talk about it. Because telling the story doesn't make much sense if you've got the wrong fella in the story. And so we'll try to work our way through some of that. But this particular segment of history, please give the time and attention to studying and reading and keeping up with who's king at what time. Now, one of the things that I need to emphasize here in introducing this material, most all of you have a lesson book, is that right? Or I should say, all of you have a lesson book. No? Well, we need to fix that. Because a lesson book is going to help you. Thank you. In your lesson book, and I left mine in the office, but in your lesson book, as you'll turn to chapter 26, I believe it is, in your lesson book, you'll find this page as the heading, lesson 26. And please notice the pages, the charts on the following pages, identifying the kings. This is a similar book, but in order to identify those charts, you'll need to hold it up like this. And the charts run this way. The period of the kings, okay? In what study I've done, that is one of the best charts of the period of the kings that I have ever seen. It's just a great chart. I'm not suggesting that there's nothing that could be changed about it, but it's a great chart, and we're going to utilize it in this class very extensively, and I'd like for you to have that chart nearby while you're reading. Because it will help you to identify the name of the king you're reading about and whether or not he served in the northern kingdom or the southern kingdom. And you can help, that chart will help you to stay on track with that. One of the things you will also notice on those charts is you will see who the prophets were during that particular period of time. Notice over to the extreme left-hand side of the page, you see dates. Okay? You see the dates? And then you see the kings of Israel, the kings of Judah, and then you see who the prophets are, and over on the right-hand side of the chart, you'll see who other nations were and their part in the picture during that particular time frame. And that'll be a very useful chart to you, I think, in your study. Someone has asked, why study in such detail some of these Old Testament events? Aren't we under the New Testament? Yes, we are under the New Testament. But as we look into the New Testament at such passages as Romans chapter 15 and verse 4, we learn that these things are written for our learning. So there's valuable lessons in studying some of this Old Testament history. That's not the only purpose for our studying Old Testament history. And a numerous amount of studies that I've had with various individuals, some have said, and I believe correctly so, that in order to appreciate what God has done for us in the sacrifice of His Son, we need to be familiar with what He did in Old Testament history to bring that about. Now, you can learn the facts of who Jesus is, you can learn the facts of what to do to become a Christian, and how to live a godly life by studying the New Testament. But to appreciate what was done on your behalf and mine, a study of this Old Testament history really enhances that because it shows us the providence of God, the power of God, the provisions of God in bringing His Son into the world that we might be saved. Now, without that, it really leaves a gaping hole in our understanding of why Jesus came. Why it was necessary. What did God do to make that happen? And then what is our attitude toward the greatness of God as we see Him involved in the scheme of redemption from the Garden of Eden, not just the sending of His Son. And so the specific now, to jump into our study tonight, in 1 Kings chapter 12, is to identify the particulars of the dividing of the kingdom. When we talk about the united kingdom, we're talking about the kingdom under the reign of what kings? Saul, David, and Solomon. That's right. Saul, David, and Solomon. Solomon's son, Rehoboam, became king. And Rehoboam was just not a very good fellow, not a very smart fellow, to say the least. We learn in the 12th chapter of 1 Kings that Rehoboam was approached by the people, and the people had a very simple desire. What was it? Lighten our load. Now, how would you like to, Carolyn, have the privilege of sitting in the council of numerous old heads, old men, who had sat in the council of not only your father, but your father, Solomon, the wisest man who had ever lived? You think they would have something beneficial to listen to? You would like to think. You know, I've talked with young men before about attitudes like Rehoboam and attitudes toward older men. And I've suggested that even if you come to a conclusion that you don't believe what that old man believes, because of his age and experience, you would do well to at least listen. I think that's good advice. He may be wrong, but it would do you a service just to listen. And so as we look at the opportunity that Rehoboam had to listen to the counsel of these old men who had sat with his father when his father was king, it tells us beginning in verse 6, "And King Rehoboam took counsel with the old men that had stood before Solomon his father while he yet lived, saying, What counsel give ye me to return answer to this people? And they spake unto him, saying, If thou wilt be a servant unto this people this day, and wilt serve them and answer them and speak good words to them, then they will be thy servants forever. Now let's look at the counsel that the old men gave. The old men are not saying to young Rehoboam, you just need to be guided by the young people or the people of the nation of Israel. That's not what he said. The old men said, you need to be a servant to these people. What was it that King Solomon wanted to be? When he asked God for wisdom, why did he ask God for wisdom? To know how to rule this great people. Well, there's a great deal involved in knowing how to rule. When we come into the New Testament and we begin to read about the qualifications of elders, we know that one of the qualifications of elders, he is to be able to rule his own house, and then the qualification is explained. For if he knows not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God? Now we look at those two little words, know how. Solomon acknowledged that he did not know how. We know that Solomon was a very young man when he became king. And he is acknowledging that he needs to know how to rule these people. These old men that sat in council with Solomon, they're trying to tell Rehoboam what they've learned about the how-to of ruling this great people. Now, if you want to rule a great people, do you rule these people with a hammer over their head? How do you successfully rule a people like these people? You make yourself a servant to them. You lead them. You lead them. Now, Rehoboam has not learned that. And so the old men say, you lead these people. You make yourself a servant to them. One of the elders that I knew in Arkansas, he's been dead a long time now, he told me, he said, I have a hard time asking the brethren to do something that I either can't or won't do myself. Now we were talking about such things as things that needed to be done around the building, which we understand that that's not necessarily a part of the work of elders as elders. In other words, it's not the elder's job, according to scriptures, to be sure that the light bulbs are all changed and everything functions properly. Now, I think sometimes folks believe that that's in the fine print down there somewhere, but that's not the God-given role of elders. Now, that doesn't mean an elder can't change a light bulb. That's not my point. But this particular man said that he wanted to try to get people involved in doing things that he could lead them in doing. Rehoboam doesn't understand that. Rehoboam thinks that to be a king is to rule with an iron fist. And therein lies the problem. As you look at the text, it tells us in verse 8 that he forsook the counsel of the old men, which they had given him, and took counsel with the young men that were grown up with him and stood before him. And he said unto them, what counsel give ye that we may return answer to these this people who have spoken unto me, saying, make the yoke that thy father did put upon us lighter. And the young men that were grown up with him spake unto him, saying, thus shalt thou say to this people that spake unto thee, saying, thy father made our yoke heavy, but make thou it lighter unto us. Thus shalt thou speak unto them, my little finger is thicker than my father's loins. And now, whereas my father did lade you with a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. My father chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scorpions. The younger men, what advice do they give to Rehoboam? Come down hard. You show them who's the king. Show them who's boss. Well, now let me ask you. There's a time for that. All of us have at one time or another worked for an employer that had the authority over us to tell us what to do and how to do it. But let me ask you, my friends, do you work harder for a boss that becomes a servant to you, or do you work harder for a boss that's determined to browbeat you into subjection? Well, it seems easier to do the first. Now, I understand we're to work as hard as we can for any boss that we have, and therein comes the rub. But it's easier to work for someone who makes themselves a servant to you. These old men recognized that, and they tried to instruct Solomon or Rehoboam regarding that, but he wouldn't listen. In verse 12, so Jeroboam and all the people came to Rehoboam the third day as the king bade, saying, come to me again the third day. And the king answered the people roughly and forsook the counsel of the old men which they had given him and spake unto them after the counsel of the young men, saying, my father made you your yoke heavy, and I will add to your yoke. My father chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scorpions. So the king hearkened not unto the people, for it was a thing brought about by Jehovah, that he might establish his word with Jehovah, or which Jehovah spake by Ahijah the Silonite to Jeroboam the son of Nebat. Now, two things I want to see. One is the error on the part of Rehoboam. Rehoboam's choice was foolish. Secondly, this next verse 15, takes us back to the previous chapter, to chapter 11, to show us that this thing is indeed the will of God. When you go back to chapter 11, we read about a man whose name is Jeroboam. And Jeroboam has fled to Egypt. Why? Why did Jeroboam flee from Solomon to Egypt? Awful quiet. All right. He lifted up his hand against the king. That's right. He did. Verse 26. And so King Solomon really sought to kill him, and he was fleeing to get away from him. Now, when King Solomon had multiplied wives and all of those kind of things, what did God decide he was going to do with King Solomon's kingdom? I'm going to end it. I'm going to take it away from you. But I'm not going to do it during your lifetime. I'm going to do it during your son's lifetime. When the prophet Ahijah meets up with Jeroboam back over in the 11th chapter, he told Jeroboam that God is going to rend the kingdom from Solomon. And he said, I'm going to give 10 of the tribes to you. And here's how he told him. Look, if you will, at verse 30 and 31. It says, and Ahijah laid hold on the new garment that was on him and rent it in 12 pieces and said to Jeroboam, take thee 10 pieces, for thus saith Jehovah, the God of Israel, behold, I will rend the kingdom out of the hand of Solomon and will give 10 tribes unto thee. Now, you'll notice in verse 33, it says, because they have forsaken me and have worshipped Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, Chemoth, the god of Moab, and Milcom, the god of the children of Ammon, and they have not walked in my ways to do that which is right in mine eyes, and to keep my statutes and mine ordinances, as did David his father. Now this is the consequence, and it's going to come to pass on his sons, rend it out of his son's hand, verse 35. That would be out of the hand of Rehoboam. Now to Jeroboam, it is promised in verse 38, and it shall be, if thou wilt hearken unto all that I command thee, and wilt walk in my ways, and do that which is right in mine eyes, to keep my statutes and my commandments, as David my servant did, that I will be with thee, and I will build thee a sure house, as I built for David. I will give Israel unto thee, and I will for this afflict the seed of David, but not forever. Solomon sought therefore to kill Jeroboam. Here it is. But Jeroboam arose and fled unto Egypt, unto Shishak, king of Egypt, and was in Egypt until the death of Solomon. So that tells us what could have been with Jeroboam. What could have been? God could have established his lineage, the lineage of the northern empire, if Jeroboam would choose to be faithful to God and keep his commandments and statutes, which we're going to see he did not do. But going back to Rehoboam and the foolishness of his choice, we note that the children of Israel, the northern 10 tribes, rebelled and made Jeroboam their king, reading beginning in verse 19 of chapter 12. It says, "So Israel rebelled against the house of David unto this day, and it came to pass, when all Israel heard that Jeroboam was returned, that they sent and called him unto the congregation and made him king over all Israel. There was none that followed the house of David but the tribe of Judah only." And you'll note that Rehoboam responded to that. He gathered together an army of 80,000 people, and he was going to fight against the northern 10 tribes and subjugate them. Now, you see that attitude displayed earlier by the young men. You show them who's king. You show them who's the boss. Now, Rehoboam is going to force their subjection. And what did God say about that? No, you're not going to do that. Don't do that. But what we do know is God told Rehoboam that this thing is of me. Don't do that. In verse 26 of chapter 12, it says, "And Jeroboam said in his heart, Now will the kingdom return to the house of David if this people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of Jehovah at Jerusalem. Then will the heart of this people turn again unto their Lord, even unto Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they will kill me and return to Rehoboam, king of Judah." Now let's look at our map, if I can get to it here. The kingdom divides, and of course the people gather at Shechem, and this is where their desire is expressed. Let me get to the map. I've got a map. Where's the map? Well, I don't want to go past that too far. The map. Where's the map? Well, I'll stop right there. But what I want you to see is that the northern kingdom divides. And as far as the northern kingdom, as far as size is concerned, even as far as the number of people is concerned, winds up being close to the same, because many of the priests that were in the northern population moved into the southern population. But what I want you to see in these verses is that the city of Jerusalem was in the southern portion kingdom. Maps on slide number 7. Okay. There we go. Appreciate that. Here's Jerusalem. And you'll see that it's just to the south of what we would call the border between the northern and the southern kingdom. Now, Jeroboam is the king of the northern kingdom. And his concern is that the people up here will go to Jerusalem in time of sacrifice, and when they go to sacrifice in Jerusalem, where then will their loyalties return? To Rehoboam, who's king in Jerusalem. So to avoid that, what does he do? Yes? One at Dan and Bethel. Look at where it is. Right almost on the line. Dan and Bethel. Now, when he did that, his desire was, let's not be having them go down here to Jerusalem. I'll lose their loyalty. Page 101, all right, in your book. Page 101 on your book for the equivalent map. You can see it up close and personal. Now, while you have that map in your book up close and personal, let me back up here a little bit, a few slides, and get to a point that I want to make regarding what Jeroboam did. What Jeroboam did. Okay. Get to where I want to be. Okay, that's still not where I want to be. Here's where I want to be. This division, we talked about this earlier, I think when we were studying the Judges. But this division between the northern 10 tribes and the southern 2 tribes, Israel and Judah, we've noticed the distinctive use of those terms in times gone by. In fact, we noted that Ephraim showed resentment during the days of Gideon in Judges chapter 7. And Benjamin, you recall, chose to fight rather than to submit to the other tribes during the days of the Judges in chapter 19 and chapter 20. And we've seen this rift continue to grow and brew. We've talked about that between the northern and the southern kingdom. And now we've got a full-fledged split in the kingdom over the leadership of Jeroboam and Rehoboam. But what Jeroboam did regarding the dividing of the kingdom, look at the last portion of chapter 12. Chapter 12. Well, we talked about that in 2 Samuel 19. You recall the rift that occurred between Israel and Judah on the return of David after he left Mahanaim and crossed the River Jordan there at Gilgal. But in 1 Kings chapter 12, in verse 12, I'm sorry, verse 31 is where I want to pick it up. Verse 31. It said, he made houses of high places and made priests from among all the people that were not of the sons of Levi. And Jeroboam ordained a feast in the ninth month on the 15th day of the month, the eighth month on the 15th day. What did I say? Eighth month on the 15th day of the month, like unto the feast that is in Judah. And he went up unto the altar, so did he in Bethel, sacrificing unto the calves that he had made. And he placed in Bethel the priest of the high places that he had made. And he went up unto the altar which he had made in Bethel on the 15th day of the eighth month, even in the month which he had devised of his own heart. For he ordained a feast for the children of Israel and went up unto the altar to burn incense. What did Jeroboam do? He said, well, he changed everything. He did. He changed the place of worship. He changed the priesthood. He changed the sacrifices, as it were. He changed the time when the sacrifices were to be offered. He changed everything as he devised in his own heart. Now, what's the problem with that? We've seen evidence of that before. What's happened historically when man presumed to act upon his own authority and reject the authority of God? Bad things. Bad things happen. And so that's what we see here. Between these two kingdoms, obviously friction has developed in the past, and it simply worsens now as a result of this. But as we consider, well, I've already talked about that. If he remained faithful, I'm getting ahead of myself on my lesson past the charts. There we go. He inaugurated a whole new system of worship. He did that which ensured his downfall. And Jeroboam's son was murdered and his family completely wiped out. And we'll talk about that when we get over to the 15th chapter, there beginning in verse 16, the death of his son and the end of his so-called dynasty reigning as king in the northern 10 tribes. But as you look at the 13th chapter, Whereupon the king took counsel and made two calves of gold, and he said unto them, it is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. Yes, I don't know that I read that, but I don't know that I did, but his argument is it's too much for you to go to Jerusalem. It's more convenient for you to go to Dan and to Bethel. Oh, yes, okay, yeah, we need to make note of that because that's his argument. He's in fear of losing the loyalty of the people. And then his argument is, it's too much for you to do that. Well, yes, I mean, he's introduced idolatry among these people as king. The whole thing's wrong. He's changed the priesthood, he's changed the place of worship, he's changed everything. All according to his own desire. And again, his argument is, it's just too much for you to do that. You can't be going to Jerusalem. So you need to do that here. Now, though that's stated as he speaks to the people, was that his real motive? Well, of course not. Isn't that interesting?
So they've gone back, really, to worshiping what the Egyptians worshiped. It says, though they considered themselves Egyptians.
That's right. Look, if you will, where is it that Jeroboam has been? He's been in Egypt. And he's lived in Egypt until Solomon died. I think it would be a safe assumption to say he's been there for quite a little while. And now that Solomon is dead, he's come back and been made king. So he brought back the religion of the Egyptians. Yeah. Well, that's right. Well, that's right. And you've raised an interesting curiosity on my part. When the people in Exodus chapter 32 call upon Aaron to make for them a golden calf, do they refer plural? Yeah. Well, their request was, up, make us gods, verse 1. Shall go before us. As for this Moses, we know not what has come of him. Yes, so the plural is used there as well. That's interesting. 32, verse 1. And then in verse 4, they said, these are thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. Yeah. Yes. Well, it makes you shake your head and wonder, doesn't it? It does indeed. But that's where we are. Well, it has, and I think there's a lesson there that we not allow not only the religions round about us to contaminate our thinking, but the world in which we live to contaminate the way that we think. Exactly right. And we see that that was a problem in New Testament churches. Case in point, as we talked about Sunday morning, the case of the fornicating brother in the church in Corinth in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. This was the backdrop against which the Corinthians lived, the idolatrous nature of that city, the immoral, ungodly ways of the city. And now we find here is a brother in Christ that's practicing immorality even beyond what the immorality of such a wicked place would tolerate. And it's being tolerated by the brethren. Well, what? Yes, he did. Well, Paul did. Yes. Exactly right. So there's valuable lessons in this. And so Jeroboam was afraid. He was afraid he would lose control. And so it's too far for you to go to Jerusalem. You need to go to Dan and to Bethel and worship there and worship these golden calves that no doubt the source of which such idolatry came from Egypt. Yeah, it's just right on the line. Yeah. And just what's on the other side of the line. Jerusalem is not far on the other side of the line, but it's too far to go to Jerusalem, you see. So, yeah, that's his argument. Good observations. Any other points or things of interest to discuss before we look at the 13th chapter? Well, as you look at the 13th chapter, we read of a man that doesn't have a name. He's referred to simply as the man of God. And a good lesson in this chapter, Randy, I believe, when we read about this man of God, you can talk about who he is and so forth and so on, but let's talk about what he was obligated to do. In verse 2 of the text, it tells us that he cried against the altar by the word of Jehovah and said, O altar, altar, thus saith Jehovah, behold, a son shall be born unto the house of David, Josiah by name. And upon these shall he sacrifice the priest of the high places that burn incense upon thee, and men's bones shall they burn upon thee. Now this man of God is making a prophecy of what's going to happen at this altar that has been built by Jeroboam in Bethel. Now, in 2 Kings chapter 23, Randy, would you like to read just a few verses for me? Beginning about verse 15, 2 Kings chapter 23, beginning at verse 15. Now, what can you tell me while he's turning to that about King Josiah? He was an 8-year-old king. That's right, appointed when he was 8. What else can you tell me about him? All right, very good king. Many reforms he made among the people of God. And in this text, begin reading, if you will, at verse 15, and tell me about this altar that Jeroboam had built in Bethel. 2 Kings 23, 15 beginning. Or you could read down through verse 20. It would be sufficient. You know, that sounds sort of like a fulfillment of what this man of God said over here in 1 Kings chapter 13, doesn't it? Well, notice that it took years to bring it about, but during the reign of King Josiah, he brought that about. And, of course, what was the purpose? Not only of burning and destroying the altar, but burning men's bones on the altar. That desecrated the altar. That's right. So this altar that King Jeroboam had set up not only was without authority, it was destroyed by Josiah, desecrated by Josiah, prophesied by the man of God who spoke against it. Now if you'll pick up the reading, going back to 1 Kings chapter 13, it says he gave the sign the same day, saying that this is the sign which Jehovah has spoken. Behold, the altar shall be rent, and the ashes that are upon it shall be poured out. And it came to pass, when the king heard the saying of the man of God, which he cried against the altar in Bethel, that Jeroboam put forth his hand from the altar, saying, lay hold on him. And his hand, which he put forth against him, dried up so that he could not draw it back again to him. And the altar also was rent, and the ashes poured out from the altar, according to the sign which the man of God had given by the word of God. Now, what was it that Jeroboam is smitten with at this point? What happened to Jeroboam? He's got a withered hand. What does he now think of this young prophet? I need your help. Fix my hand. And so the young prophet says, I'll fix your hand. And he did, made it like it was before. And then Jeroboam said, I want you to go home with me and dine with me. And the young man said, no, I can't do that. Why can't I do that? All right, God told me I can't do that. God told me that I can't go home the same way that I came, and I'm not to eat or to drink along the way. Now, he refused the hospitality of the king. Note that. But dropping down in the text, in verse 11, It says, "Now there dwelt an old prophet in Bethel, and one of his sons came and told him all the works of the man of God that the man of God had done in Bethel, the words which he had spoken unto the king. Them also they told unto their father. And their father said unto them, What way went he? Now his sons had seen what way the man of God went that came from Judah. And he said unto his sons, Saddle me the ass. And they saddled him the ass, and he rode thereon. And he went after the man of God, and found him sitting under an oak. And he said unto him, Art thou the man of God that comest from Judah? And he said, I am. Then he said unto him, Come home with me, and eat bread. And what did the young prophet, the man of God, say to the old prophet? Can't do that. Well, why not? God told me. What did God tell me? All right, so can't do that. And how does the old prophet respond to the young prophet? He lied to him. What did he tell him? Juan? All right. He told me you could. But he lied to him. Now, we know that the rest of the story is described beginning in verse 20. What happened to the young prophet? A lion killed him. A lion killed him. Now, when the old prophet heard that the young prophet lay dead, how did he respond? It's all my fault. I did it. So he went and got him and carried him and buried him in his own tomb. And we learn, as you said, he mourned over him and all of that sort of thing. But as you pick up the reading, beginning at verse 31, it says, It came to pass after he had buried him that he spake unto his sons, saying, When I am dead, then bury me in the sepulcher wherein the man of God is buried. Lay my bones beside his bones, for the saying which he cried by the word of Jehovah against the altar in Bethel, and against all the house of the high places which are in the cities of Samaria, shall surely come to pass. All right, so this old prophet, he learns what he's done, and the consequences of it. Now, what has the young prophet learned? He's learned a whole lot of lessons. Yes. Absolutely right. Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, he doesn't even acknowledge, Jeroboam doesn't, God anymore. That's right. Very good. Yeah, 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 that's true. That's true. He disobeyed the mouth of the Lord. Well, that becomes the bottom line, doesn't it? I want you to observe, if you will, in the reading of this, that this young prophet, he obviously has learned that what God had to say was all that God had to say. God's... No modern day prophets. No. Yes. That's right. This was all that God had to say. The young man had heard everything. Wasn't going to be any more. Now, when this old prophet came with a new message, the young prophet's attitude should have been, I've already heard all that God has to say on that. So what you have doesn't interest me. Okay? I have to go with what God said. I find it interesting as well in this that though the old prophet lied to him, God did use the old prophet to tell the young prophet what's going to happen to you. Look, if you will, in the text at verse 20, it came to pass as they sat at the table that the word of Jehovah came into the prophet that brought him back. And he cried unto the man of God that came from Judah, saying, Thus saith Jehovah, for as much as thou hast been disobedient unto the mouth of Jehovah, and hast not kept the commandment which Jehovah thy God commanded thee, but camest back, and hast eaten bread and drunk water in the place of which he said to thee, Eat no bread and drink no water, thy body shall not come unto the sepulcher of thy fathers. Who told the young prophet that? The old prophet did. That's right. So God did speak to the old prophet, but he didn't speak to him the words that the old prophet had represented. He lied. Now, there's a rule of thumb in that. Be sure you've got the truth on that and you've got the final saying on it before you act. Okay? Well, we learn in verse 33 that after this thing, chapter 13, verse 33, after this thing, Jeroboam returned not from his evil way, but made again from all the people priests of the high places. Whosoever would, he consecrated him that there might be priest in the high places. And this thing became sin unto the house of Jeroboam, even to cut it off and to destroy it from the face of the earth. Jeroboam becomes a very prominent Old Testament figure in our thinking, because when we read of other idolatrous kings, whether they're worse or moderately better, they're compared to Jeroboam. I want you to notice that in your reading of this period of the divided kingdom. Sure. Right. That's right. He killed him and stood by him. Mm-hmm. He didn't kill him. That's right. So there's some valuable lessons to learn from this young prophet. The divided kingdom. This gets us into somewhat of the text of the overall rest of the story. The southern kingdom of Judah still worshiped God at the temple in Jerusalem. Oftentimes it was only a ritual worship. It's heartbreaking to see the beginning of the moral and religious decay of this period. The description from Dan to Bethel here, or Bethel as it's sometimes pronounced, shows us where the boundaries essentially of the northern kingdom were. We noted just briefly earlier that the Levites moved south. Other faithful people to God moved south, and the two kingdoms were near to the same size in terms of their number. But this period lasted for about 20 years. Now, Richard, you or someone commented about how long it has been since they have come into the promised land. These numbers are very important, because as we come over into 2 Peter chapter 3, we learn that time doesn't change what God has said. And though hundreds of years may pass, we see that the plan of God is right on track. It's right on course. And nothing changes about that. And so we're going to talk about that as we pursue. Mark, if you would 1 Kings chapter 14, and we'll try to pick up our study there.